I'd love to get you on a slow boat to China, all to myself, alone. Get you and keep you in my arms evermore. Leave all your lovers a-weeping on a faraway shore. Way out on the briny with the moon big and shiny, melting your heart of stone. I wanna get you on a slow boat to China, all to myself, alone.
Hello and welcome to The Collision, Collider's podcast about movies, TV, and more. I'm the site's managing editor, and with me today is associate editor Adam Chitwood.
Hello.
Today, we're going to have a bit of a sad Collision podcast. We originally intended to just talk about some of the week's news stories, like Super Bowl ads and then this Batman Superman news, and then earlier today it was reported that great actor Philip Seymour Hoffman had died at the age of 46, and so those topics just seem kind of frivolous, and we just, for me personally, and I think Adam probably agrees this, we just want to like talk about his work, you know, just very heavy, and you just, in these moments, you look back at a filmography, and when you look at it as a whole, it just kind of strikes you at how consistently good he was. But I think it goes deeper than that. And Adam, just to quickly, I don't feel like I'm not misspeaking for you when I say that, like, you kind of want to get some stuff off your chest regarding, like, you know, about his filmography to say some things. Just
no,
to get it out there.
he was like a giant. I mean, I was with my girlfriend when the news hit, and we were talking about how, you know, there was no one else like him. Like the, and I mean, not to diminish the death of Paul Walker, who was by all accounts a fantastic guy, but you know, when you're thinking of, you know, a movie that might have starred Paul Walker, you can replace it with a different actor and you get kind of the same performance. But you look at some of Philip Seymour Hoffman's work, like you cannot imagine that the lead role in The Master being what it was without Hoffman. It would have been a completely different performance. He's a wholly singular actor. Like if you look at his roles, like you can't pigeonhole him as like, oh, it's going to be this kind of performance. It's a Philip Seymour Hoffman performance. You can't say like, oh, it's going to be, you know, the action leading man guy, or we need a this kind of guy. He was just, I mean, he was wholly unique, and he was like, I mean, there's just no replacement. There's not like you can say like, oh, well, we didn't get Philip Seymour Hoffman, so we'll go to this guy. You know, it was, you knew he was going to bring something completely different to the role.
And one of the things that's special about him is that he was very career conscious in the sense of not being pigeonholed, to where I think around the Along Came Polly time, I think maybe he kind of got a flash of, oh crap, I might start being, oh, you know, this best friend kind of role. And from there he goes to Capote. And Capote was a role he basically worked to craft and create. Like that film exists because of him. That was a big thing, and obviously that took his career to another level. But obviously, even before Capote, he was doing great supporting work. And one of the things I want to talk about is that supporting work, because he still had lead roles from time to time, but there's so much supporting work in his filmography. And I think when we talk, I think that maybe leads us to overlook him in his life, and it's only, you know, now that he just died that we sort of get the whole sense of it. Because Adam, you're completely right, you have trouble seeing anyone else in a role, and yet I suppose when we're dream casting things, like his name doesn't necessarily come up because he's so utility, he just defies simple categorization. And yet, as a supporting player, he is so key in the sense of, I believe acting, great acting, is about balance and restraint and respecting your fellow actors. And that while flashy performances get attention and are still worthy of attention, for sure. I don't think that Meryl Streep is a bad actress, you know, for taking these leading, challenging roles. But I think there's a lot to be said for an actor who understands the balance that is required to help the film overall. And I think you see that time and time again in his filmography.
Especially in his work with Paul Thomas Anderson.
Oh, especially in that.
Because that's all, like, him just, like, giving, like, layups, being a supporting... I mean, Boogie Nights is one of my... That's one of my favorite roles of his, is Scotty in that movie. And it's just such a... It's such a, like, hilarious and fantastic performance, but it's so key to the Dirk Diggler character and to what happens around the rest of the movie. And that, I mean, Paul Thomas Anderson kind of used him as, you know, his ace up his sleeve in all of his films, and then, you know, obviously gave him a starring role in The Master, which, you know, it's kind of sad to think that, you know, maybe there would have been another lead in a Paul Thomas Anderson movie somewhere down the road, but his supporting work in those movies are, I mean, it's unparalleled.
Absolutely. And to me, it's a matter of professionalism. It's so tempting for actors to want to try to steal the spotlight because it helps their careers and sticks in the minds of audiences. And again, going back to Capote, he's like, well, I'm going to play Capote. This is my role. But for supporting actors, they need to understand balance. And I think Amy Adams has that as well. And I mentioned her because they co-starred together in Doubt and The Master. And I think part of that is the way they balance other characters. You have Joaquin Phoenix and Meryl Streep as the big performances, and that's not to take away from their work at all. But you have actors like Hoffman and Adams understanding the room and what needs to be done, but also making the role their own. And when you can see that it's not all about flash, but it's about balance, and like you're saying, layups, and really feeling out how to best work the scene with your fellow actors, that's incredibly generous and professional.
I mean, even Along Came Polly, his scenes in that movie just cracked me up. Let It Rain!
Oh, yeah. I don't mean to, like, shit all over Along Came Polly for him.
No, I'm saying that even in, like, comedic roles, like, or comedic movies, or even, like, a lesser movie, like, it's no less important for him to be that kind of, that really supporting character.
Exactly. And, I mean, I'm going through, looking at his IMDb page, and it's not just, like, oh, man, he is good in all of these, but you think about how he's good and that he just keeps defying definition. And if you say to me Mission Impossible 3, I think of him as, and that is kind of like a nothing film. It's a film that's like, it's fun and it's flighty and you start forgetting it as moment it's over, except for him. And I think it's one of my favorite villain performances because it's a villain who could not give less of a shit about the hero. It's a villain who is so powerful he has no respect for the hero whatsoever. He's like, you're a thing in my way. Like, he's just so bored with Ethan Hunt. And it's so entertaining. And it's such a fascinating way to approach a character, to approach a villain, because usually the villain's like, ah, you're in my way and I have to do everything to stop you. He's like, you have a girlfriend? I'm gonna find her. I'm gonna kill her. I'm gonna kill her. And I'm gonna, like, it's just like, it's great just how casual he is with it. And that kind of intelligence to bring that to a role is wonderful. And I can't think of another actor who, I'm thinking of other villains and other actors obviously being their spin to other villains. But you took a villain like Mission Impossible 3, which is a very generic villain. On the page, it's like he wants to do something like it. He was after like a MacGuffin. That was it. That's what he's after a MacGuffin. Like, this isn't the Joker, but he's doing so much with it.
No, it's a fun role. And then, and he is the one that you kind of remember from that film. And I think a similar, he gives a similar performance or a similar kind of performance in Moneyball, which is a very small role. Obviously he worked with Bennett Miller before on Capote, but it's just another one of those, you know, like, you know, I'm doing my thing. I do not care about you or like what you have to say or what you're doing. Like, I'm doing what I have to do. And he just plays that like understated kind of thing so well. He never kind of explodes or anything.
Yeah. And I mean, that's the thing of, and he did that in other roles as well. That sort of, that just very dismissive, you're beneath me, but not that kind of like phoned in performance. Yeah. Of, and yet the thing that I love is you look at Hoffman from a physical perspective, and to have that such range that he can fit into all these different things, but you take that role of like him being very dismissive, and it's like, here's kind of a heavy set guy, kind of pasty and pale, and he can make you feel like you're nothing.
Yeah.
Like, that's kind of incredible to take someone who, from a physical standpoint, doesn't, you know, overwhelm, and yet it's the personality of it, to fill the screen with a personality that makes you feel like shit.
That's the thing, he just fills these movies that you feel his presence everywhere. And I mean, famously in Almost Famous, where he's fantastic as Lester Bangs, he shot all of his scenes while he was incredibly sick. I think he had the flu or something, and he just, like, that Lester Bangs character is so crucial to the movie as a whole. He's like, time and time again, in a lot of these supporting roles, he's not in the movie that much, but he's so memorable, and he plays such a key part in them, and you feel that presence throughout the rest of the movie because he's so good and because he brings something so different to it. I remember watching the behind the scenes on Magnolia, and Paul Thomas Anderson was, they were on the set together, and he was ribbing. He was like, here's how I write the scene, and you know, it's like, you know, X character walks from the table to the bed, and he just walks. He's like, and here's how Philip does the scene, and he starts over at the table, and he starts like messing with things and doing all this business and doing just all kinds of weird things. He's just like changing it up and improvising, like grabbing stuff and throwing them on the ground and touching everything, because that's what he would do. He would just add these flourishes to his performance that were not in the script or not, you know, necessarily obvious, but they brought so much to that character and so much. They just fleshed it out. It was all these little artistic flourishes without going overboard that just kind of made it such a memorable performance.
Yeah, I'm just checking Twitter at the moment, and his family just released a statement, so I figured I'd read that. We are devastated by the loss of our beloved Phil and appreciate the outpouring of love and support we have received from everyone. This is a tragic and sudden loss, and we ask that you respect our privacy during this time of grieving. Please keep Phil in your thoughts and prayers. And I obviously think that's a given. Well, for people who have souls, that's a given to just, like, not invade their privacy. And obviously our hearts go out to them. Every time this happens, a great actor dies. It's very... I think it's important to remember that they had lives of their own, and in a sense of it, you know, we feel like they belong to us because they, and they do in a sense because their performances are, and yet there are people in their personal lives who we never see. And that's the thing. And I feel for them because they know this person in a way that no one else did. And that kind of unique relationship is over. And so, and I'm not saying like, and I'm glad I remember this, but everyone else, like, I'm not trying to be chastising. I do feel really bad for them, because by accounts of what I'm reading from people who just met him briefly, they all said he was very friendly, and just someone very professional and nice, which is always nice to hear. But returning to his film work, although before we do, he also did a lot of stage work, and sadly I never saw any of it, but people on Twitter I know are like raving about True West, which is one where he switched performances with his co-star every night. I'm trying to look that up.
True West with
John C. Reilly. With John C. Reilly, he traded roles nightly with John C. Reilly in True West. So yeah, that's, again, it's something where a lot of people know his film work, but he did more stuff on the side because as a professional actor, he just wanted to do more. Like, it's not just film roles. I like the breadth of that he did more. And actually, as I was you know, thinking about that, and we're looking at the rise of television, I'm like, oh man, what it would have been like to see him in long form, to see him do like a True Detective kind of thing where it's like, or anything like that.
Well, he had a show on Showtime that had just been ordered to series called Happiness.
Was that based on the Todd Solondz one, or is that
called Happy-ish? I'm not sure.
Oh, Happy-ish, yeah. Not Happiness. No, okay.
No. Happy-ish. Like that would, he had shot the pilot, and Showtime had just ordered it to series. And he seemed to be doing, I mean, it reminds me of when Heath Ledger died. It was really sad, but also really angering, because you just think of what will be missing, because you know, obviously Heath Ledger was young and he felt like he was on the cusp of touching greatness, but Philip Seymour Hoffman had touched that greatness in it, and he seemed to be in an exciting time in his career when he was kind of branching out. He had the Showtime series, and he was kind of playing with franchise stuff too, with the Hunger Games, and you know, I really enjoyed what he did with the Plutarch Evensby role in Catching Fire, and was really looking forward to seeing kind of...
Oh yeah, he absolutely stole those scenes. Not intentionally, I mean, not that that was his goal, but he was so magnetic as like a new character coming on the scene. And that's one of the things I like about that movie, is that it introduces a bunch of new characters and the casting is great all around. But again, he just has that charisma
that's never overstated. Where he took the character in Mockingjay, and I guess Lionsgate released a statement today saying that his work on Mockingjay Part 1 was essentially complete, but he had 7 days left of filming on Mockingjay Part 2, so... I mean,
they'll figure it out.
Yeah.
They always do. They apparently, it's still on schedule, so...
Sure.
But, again, the larger loss here, is, as you're saying, is what else could he have done? Because he did so much. He just couldn't pigeonhole him, and... Everyone on following on Twitter is like pointing out like different favorite things he did.
I think one
person I followed just did a screen cap of him from Big Lebowski. Just a brand, just that small role, and just the way, like, how nervous he is, and the way he moves his arms against his body when he's upset. Like, who does that? But it's just this great little touch.
Even Twister, a movie like that, where it's just a blockbuster, like a studio blockbuster movie, but he's such a kind of goofy guy as Dusty in Twister.
Yes. Yeah, it's just something constantly surprising, and in a weird way, that was, I guess you could call Philip Seymour Hoffman the constant variable. The one guy, like, he's gonna do something different every time.
Yeah, and that's what, I mean, if you have Magnolia on Blu-ray or DVD, I suggest seeking out those extras, because that's essentially what Paul Thomas Anderson was doing. He was like, and here's how Phil does the scene, because it's just constant, just you don't know what he's gonna do, and it's different. I just watched Hard Eight for the first time 2 days ago, and he only has one scene in that movie, but just his delivery and like when he chooses to pause and everything, it's one scene, but it you remember it throughout the rest of the film.
Right, it's really just something that sticks with you, and just he has that memory. It's just the little things. I mean, he is not in Punch Drunk Love for very much, and there's certain things I remember that, but just the shouting match he has at the end with Adam Sandler, like, it's just like just trying to match pace with the film and the scene and just leaving a mark just by doing his job. That's the other thing. It never felt like, it felt showy in the sense that it's just like, this is how I do my job. Like, it didn't ever feel forced with Hoffman.
No, felt very natural.
Yeah. And it was always fun to sort of see him just take on different roles. I mean, you look at Red Dragon, and, you know, it's a fun role in the original Manhunter, in Michael Mann's Manhunter, but then the way he plays it is just completely different and yet perfect.
Yeah.
And finding his own tone for it. And again, just going through the filmography, I think, you know, Marion Mack's vocal performance, there's so much of him in it, even, you know, it's just his voice. It's that kind of like I said, leaving an impression. So, I mean, that's a broad overview in terms of, we're just jumping around, and we're going to talk a little bit about specific films more in depth, but before we do, he had two films at Sundance this year, and one was God's Pocket, which I think is a testament to, even in bad films, he was excellent in them. Like, he is probably one of the few great things about that movie. But I didn't see a Most Wanted Man, and you did, Adam. I was wondering if you could talk about that for just a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, that's another one.
Because he's the star of that movie.
He's the star of that movie. It's Anton Corbin, who did The American. And it's a very different performance. It's very much him, and it's this very quiet, understated performance. He plays a German basically kind of like a contracted spies who work for, not necessarily for the German government, but they kind of do the things that the German government can't do, and they're kind of rooting out terrorism. And he plays it with just such ease. He's playing it. It's a post 9/11 film told from a non-American perspective. So he's kind of playing a character who's a bit, not jaded, but frustrated with kind of how everything is going, and it's all kind of quiet. But as it gets towards the end, his performance starts to crescendo, and you see kind of the passion breaking through. And it's a really understated performance from him, and it's a really interesting performance from him. And it's great. He has some really great scenes opposite Robin Wright in that movie. And I mean, just as you said that, Matt, it looks like we've seen two of his last three performances that he'll ever have, since we saw those at Sundance, God's Pocket and Most Wanted Man, and then Hunger Games. It looks like those are the last things that he shot, and then the pilot for the
Showtime series. And who knows if we'll ever see that.
Yeah, kind of like the HBO and Gandolfini. He shot a pilot for HBO as well. But right. His performance in Most Wanted Man is fantastic, and you know, it'll be nice to get that one out there so people can see it.
Yeah. Absolutely, just because to have people talking about it. So just going through, and I'm now going through, and I feel a little bad because one of his biggest roles was Happiness, and I'm not a huge Todd Solondz fan. I kind of dislike all of his movies that I've seen in it, and that's kind of why I skipped Happiness. But now I'm like, but I kind of got to see it. It's that, I don't want to say urgency, but it's one of those, you don't appreciate them until they're gone. So Happiness is like, I'll see it eventually. But now it's like, oh, now here's a celebrated Philip Seymour Hoffman performance, and I haven't seen it. Like, people today are talking about Love, Liza. Haven't seen it, but now I want to go out and just see more.
I've never seen Cynic Doce New York, and now I get to see that now. It's just kind of sad. I feel like I need to go back and catch up on the ones that, you know, I haven't seen that or Before the Devil Knows You're Dead. Yeah. Those are kind of the two big ones that...
Well, if I can talk about those for a moment, just trying to zero in on those, because sure. I don't know how many people have seen those, but Cynic Doce New York is Charlie Kaufman's directorial debut, for those who... his name doesn't sound familiar. He's the writer of Adaptation, Being John Malkovich, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. He has a very unique perspective, really challenges things, and Cynic Doce, I can never pronounce it, is just it is a film that is very difficult to describe. If I can squeeze it into a description, it's that Philip Seymour Hoffman plays a guy who wants to recreate his entire life and world as a stage production, and so like he ends up building like a mini New York inside like a warehouse, but it sort of just becomes like this thing where it's like a box inside of a box inside a box, and he's trying to sort of get a handle on his life, and it's such a weird way. I mean, the film opens with him like poking a stick into his feces in a toilet bowl. Like, that is like, it's that kind of weird movie, but when you have like an actor like Hoffman who's just willing to go for it, it just kind of eases you in to what Kaufman is doing. And it's still a film that's baffling, I'm not gonna lie. I came out of that, I gave that film three and a half what and a huh, like I just didn't know what to make of it. It's hard to describe, but he was an actor that took chances and was willing to say, this is your vision and I'm gonna make it work. And he found, even if the plot is confusing and even if the themes are confusing, the sadness and general feeling of loneliness and feeling lost, he conveys that perfectly. And there's a song in it called Little Person, which is just heartbreaking, and it's sort of his performance. He doesn't sing it or anything, it's just a song that recurs. It's that kind of matching your performance to the tone of the film and working together. Because when that stuff gets out of sync, a movie falls apart. It just does. It's so... And it seems like, well, obviously they should just go with it, but it's one thing for an actor to sort of get absorbed in a director's vision, and it's another thing for it to be balanced with it and sort of help guide it. And I think that's what Hoffman did in Elite, and when he took lead performances, he really could direct things in a way that, as a supporting role, he is again in tune with it, but he's trying to accommodate the director's vision, and he does so brilliantly. And that's not to say one is better than the other. It's just, as a lead role, you can sort of see how it's shaped. I mean, Adam, did you sort of see that with A Most Wanted Man in terms of how, at the lead, he can sort of transform a movie?
Yeah, I mean, he carries the whole mood of the film on his shoulders, and I think he does a really great job of kind of conveying that. Like, the mood of what's happening is basically his character, and so he kind of conveys that through his performance.
Yeah. The other film we're talking about, Before the Devil Knows You're Dead, that was Sidney Lumet's final films. Lumet previously did 12 Angry, this little film called 12 Angry Men, you may have heard of it, and other classics. In that one, it's a intense family drama where it jumps around in time, but the gist of it is his character desperately needs money, and so he stages a bank robbery at his parents' store, and it goes awry. It goes horribly, horribly wrong. So he's this pathetic character who does something horrible, and yet it's that complexity. He's not just a schlub. And I think that's something that an actor of his type, in the sense of, again, going to his physical appearance and what you could easily typecast him as is, oh, the sad schlub. And he always made it more than that. And again, in the Before the Devil Knows You're Dead, it's very much a film for actors, simply because of it's so driven. I think he was attracted to those projects. Not to say, like, obviously, if he's doing Hunger Games, he liked those projects as well. He never seemed to just say, I will only do this film. When you're doing Twister and Along Came Polly, you're constantly looking for challenges. But this is something where he gets to work alongside Ethan Hawke and Albert Finney. And by the way, Albert Finney in this film, oh my God, it's pretty remarkable all around. But he has one of the lead roles in Before the Devil Knows You're Dead, and he's one of the, like, his characters, like, you kind of hate him, but you feel like, what a schmuck, how pathetic. And it's one of those roles that creates a character where you have to feel more than one way about them. Like, you just can't write them off. And that, again, finding those complexities is really rewarding. So I would say, just among the films that people may have missed, because he's done a lot, and hell, like I said, I've missed some. I've missed, I've missed Love, Liza. I've missed Happiness. So those are some. Adam, what about you? What would you say? Because we also will have our big recommendations near the end of the show, and this will probably be a short one, just because, not because, like, I mean, we could go on and on and on, but at some point I think it would feel redundant, and also I don't feel it's right to say, and now to transition to something completely different. But I do want to sort of get into more of his work. Adam, what films would you bring to people's attention?
Most of them are known. I think 25th Hour, his work in that.
Oh, again, God, 25th Hour.
Again, it's another supporting performance. I think 25th Hour is the best film about post 9/11 America that has ever been made, and probably maybe ever will be made. Spike Lee directed that. But it's another, just a really powerful supporting performance. And there's so many great scenes between him and Edward Norton and Barry Pepper in that movie that are, man, they just hit you. That's probably one of my favorites that I think people may have missed or maybe kind of overlooked. I think Boogie Nights is probably my personal favorite of his, just because it's so funny. I mean, he was a very great serious actor. I mean, you go watch The Master, and he's fantastic in that. But he had this wonderful sense of humor that I think really shines in a movie like Boogie Nights and Charlie Wilson's War, which I'll be getting to later. That'll be my recommendation. That's another one that kind of showcases that. but I mean, he was never bad. I mean, Almost Famous was my favorite movie growing up, and again, to go back to that one, I mean, that's one that it just permeates throughout the rest of the film, and it's such a key and complicated performance. But yeah, I mean, Pirate Radio, he's really good in that. Moneyball, tiny role, really good. But I guess if I was gonna pick one that maybe people might have overlooked, I would go with 25th Hour, because that's just that's a really powerful film.
And again, now I will also say he directed a film called Jack Goes Boating, and I have not seen that one.
And he had just cast the two leads in his next directorial effort last week.
Yeah. So it's a real shock all around, because like his career was still. I mean, obviously it's always a shock. It's unusual, unless they've retired, for them to be like, and nothing was going on.
Yeah.
Especially for Hoffman, who, like we said, he had two films at Sundance. He was working constantly. He still had some shooting left to do on Hunger Games. So, I mean, it's still always a shock. But like you said, it's tough to find films that... I mean, obviously, like all actors, unless you're John Cazale and have only made five of the best movies of all time, and then you die unexpectedly, like, you're going to have some films that are misses. And I know that Flawless is much maligned, and I haven't seen it. Patch Adams doesn't really hold up. But, like, it's the thing is like, no one... It's one of those things where you look at it, and I think Flawless might be the exception. I think some people take issue with his performance there. But overall, even if the film is a miss, no one's being like, and it's because of that damn Philip Seymour Hoffman. Like, he was never the reason why. Like, it's just, this film didn't work out. But again, a lot of the times, he chose right. He chose the right people to work with. And that, again, is important. It's having a sense of the room. That really is. It's having a sense of other people rather than yourself. And I think that's very generous of an actor to say, I see this person as talented and I will put my trust in them. And I think that's how you end up working with Paul Thomas Anderson on almost all of his movies.
Yeah, all but There Will Be Blood, right? That's the only one he's not in.
That's the only one he's not in.
Speaking of talented Mr. Ripley, another movie that he's fantastic in a supporting role in.
Yeah, it's just, and what's interesting is, like, we're not even talking about, like, we haven't really even touched on Capote that much.
Which
and
is incredible. Like, he just disappears into Capote. I mean, that's...
he creates the defining performance of Truman Capote. I mean, after, like, the next year, like, Infamous came out, and everyone's like, that's nice.
Yeah.
Like, there was, like, no point.
Well, and what struck me about Capote is that Philip Seymour Hoffman has a very specific delivery and a very specific voice, and in all of his characters, he sounds kind of... I mean, it's tough to take that away from him, but in Capote, he just completely... That's a transformative performance, and that's something that I was not expecting from him in that. Because, you know, a lot of his other characters, you can kind of... You know, it's unmistakably Philip Seymour Hoffman, but in Capote, like, that is just an utter transformation.
Yeah, absolutely. I think for that film, for that year, there was no question he was going to win the Oscar. I think he was pretty much the front runner all that year. There was no real question there.
Well, and it was also kind of recognizing his insane supporting work for the years prior, because that came on the heels of Cold Mountain, 25th Hour, Punch Drunk Love, Almost Famous, all his Paul Thomas Anderson work. So I think that was kind of, you know, a character actor really getting his due.
I absolutely agree. And if I look at, you know, you look at the other nominees that year, and I mean, it was good comp. It wasn't like a walk. Like, you had Heath Ledger in Brokeback Mountain, David Strathairn in Good Night and Good Luck, Terrence Howard in Hustle and Flow, and Joaquin Phoenix in Walk the Line. It wasn't like he was squaring off against a bunch of slouches that year.
That was a tough year to predict, too. I remember that. That was, you know, was Joaquin going to go walk away with it? Was it going to be Heath Ledger? But
right, and but he, I, no one was, no one afterward was like, no, he didn't deserve it. Yeah, and then of course the other one, which again we've gone on and touched on, was The Master, which is just something else entirely. It was just
I'm still puzzling over that movie.
Yeah, Oh my God, the master. I mean, that's the thing. If you're looking at what people are linking to performance-wise, they're talking, I mean, his opening monologue in that where he's explaining to Joaquin Phoenix who he is. Oh my God.
That movie is like film school porn. It's like film school student porn. That entire movie is just like the performances and the subtext and everything about it is all.
It's not my favorite Paul Thomas Anderson movie, but it's one of my favorite Philip Seymour Hoffman performances.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It's just such a meaty movie, like right down to like all of the performances are just so juicy and their interactions and everything.
Yeah, and the reason I led this podcast off with the audio of him singing Slow Boat to China is that's his final scene in the film, and it's just so sorrowful. And if you watch the scene, the camera is mostly on Joaquin Phoenix, but Hoffman's voice is just so haunting and just the pain in it. And when it does cut back to Hoffman, you're seeing a character who can really only express himself this way. And his face is like kind of shaking, but like holding it back. And it is like the master. It's a strange scene in a film of many strange scenes, but it works because he's so invested in it that this is just the way he's going to communicate in this scene to this guy that he has such a complex relationship with. So that's why I let it off. But again, I could have let it off with so many things. It was just, I think it was because it sounded so sad, and I felt really sad when I heard the news. So my mind went there to that role. But again, people are just sharing moments from his filmography that just left an impression with them.
Yeah,
because he was an actor that, you know, you didn't forget. He was a character actor in a sense, but not a hey, it's that guy.
Yeah,
not that kind of actor.
It's not that. Aren't you that guy from that thing? Like you know, like oh, that's Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Exactly. Which again is difficult for people who are primarily in supporting roles. If it's a lead role, you kind of know them again and again. But someone who keeps popping up in supporting roles, you know, you think of them as background, not as important. And he just never did that. And again, that balancing act of I'm going to be memorable, but I'm not going to scene steal or overshadow. That's tricky.
Yeah.
So those are his big ones. I would do you want to move on to recommendations before we just start like just listing off everyone?
Yeah,
because again, I think the reason why I think we mentioned Capote and The Master right now and why those aren't our recommendations is I think
because of course
exactly, you know, he was kind of good in that Master movie. So the one I'm gonna recommend this week is Doubt. The plot of Doubt is it's adapted from a stage play where Philip Seymour Hoffman's character, he plays a priest who is suspected of molesting an altar boy. And the scale of the film is very small. It feels like it's from a stage play. But his performance is the doubt. It really is, because the entire question is did he molest this child? And there's certain information, new bits of information coming into the film that fuels it. But if Hoffman tips his hand too much in any direction, the film falls apart completely. Because as the audience, we have to know. So for most of the film, he's like, oh, he seems like a guy who's being unfairly persecuted by Meryl Streep's character. He is being put under suspicion simply by coincidence, and he is not being given his due. He seems like an all right guy, and that an injustice is being done towards him. And yet, there's just enough there in the performance. The movie could have just conveyed it, just like I said, because it introduces pieces of new information that fuel it. But it's his performance that gives you this inkling, like, but maybe. Just maybe there's something in this guy that can do this.
Yeah.
And it just, again, it's the little things that's not showy, that's not overdoing it, and yet so key to the success of an entire film. So my recommendation is Doubt.
And again, with Amy Adams and Meryl Streep, like that, and Viola Davis, that cast is, I mean, that movie is like watching a play. I guess as a feature film, you couldn't say like, oh, it's an amazing feature film, but it's such a wonderful character study. And
oh God, yes. I mean, that film made Viola Davis like a star.
Yeah.
Because she only has one scene and she absolutely blows it away.
She crushes Meryl Streep.
I know. If you can crush Meryl Streep, if you can crush Meryl Streep, you get to be a movie star.
Yes.
It's like dunking on LeBron.
Yeah, exactly.
Doubt. Adam, what about you? You going with Charlie Wilson's War?
Yeah. My recommendation is Charlie Wilson's War. Directed by Mike Nichols, screenplay by Aaron Sorkin, Tom Hanks, Julia Roberts. Just like an incredible resume. It came out in 2007, and it's about the when the Soviet war was going on in Afghanistan, a U.S. senator or a U.S. representative, Charlie Wilson, worked to give the Afghan Mujahideen support to combat the Soviets. And this is about that kind of like backdoor CIA operation to do that, because this wasn't something that was publicly or widely known. This is something that, you know, it's Charlie Wilson's war. It was very small scale. And this was all made possible by a prickly CIA agent named Gust Avrakodos, played by Philip Seymour Hoffman. And it's just, I mean, it's Philip Seymour Hoffman doing Aaron Sorkin dialogue, which is incredible, I mean, in and of itself. And it's a fantastic character, and he has so many great outbursts. And there's a pure Sorkin sequence in there where Charlie Wilson is juggling meetings with other people and Gust. So Gust will come in the room and then Charlie Wilson has to do something else, so he goes back out. And just the way Hoffman plays it is so funny and so good. And it's another one of those supporting performances it's just so key and so crucial to the movie as a whole. And I don't think it's Mike Nichols' best film. I don't think it's Aaron Sorkin's best film, but it's a good film. It's really funny. It's really entertaining. And that's mostly due to the cast and script, and just watching Hoffman play off Tom Hanks as kind of boozy, you know, drug addicted U.S. Republican representative Charlie Wilson. It's a lot of fun, and it's a movie that's kind of not disappeared, but it's kind of, a lot of people I feel like have forgotten about it, and I think it's one that I'm very keen to revisit now in the wake of Hoffman's death, because I think it's just a really funny performance, and it does what Hoffman did so well, which is combining comedy and drama into a performance that was complex and singular. Like the way he would play this frustration in his roles, it was so different than anyone else. Just this, I mean, you would see that look he would give, and you know, he'd look down at the floor, and you could just kind of feel everything that his character was feeling. And I feel like he pulls that off perfectly. And this is yet another film where he shares the screen with Amy Adams. And John Slattery from Mad Men is also in this film.
Oh, I totally forgot Amy Adams is in that film
Amy
as well.
Adams,
jeez.
Yeah. And John Slattery, who directed Hoffman in God's Pocket, which was at Sundance.
Yeah. Oof. Yeah, and also in Charlie Wilson's War, another great scene is when he kind of has a monologue where he goes into the, John Slattery kind of plays his superior.
Yes.
And Hoffman's character, Gust, gets denied a job that he worked really hard for. And he just explodes off the screen in that scene.
Oh, it's so good.
Yeah.
It's
so.
Just, I mean, you think about, like, this is basically Sorkin expanding an episode of The West Wing to feature film length and giving Hoffman all the best lines.
Exactly. So, rest in peace, Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Yeah.
You will be greatly missed. If you want to keep up with this podcast, you should just follow us on Twitter. I know this wasn't a very lighthearted one, but thank you for letting us talk about it. You can follow me on Twitter at Matt Goldberg. Adam, where can we find you on Twitter?
At Adam Chitwood.
Hopefully next week we'll have something much, much more lighthearted, and horrible things won't happen to people we like. And we can talk about the Lego movie, which I think will be, I really want to talk about that one. We can talk about happy things and be upbeat. But thank you guys so much for listening, and we'll be back with you next week.
Thanks a lot, guys.